Anarchopreneur, episode number 42, Courage, Compassion, and Capitalism. All right, here we go.
Government is inefficient and should be dissolved.
What government should actually do is just leave people alone to buy and sell freely among themselves. If they just leave self-interested traders to compete with one another, markets are guided to positive outcomes as if by an invisible hand.
It's free markets that are moral because you only succeed if you meet the needs and wants of other people.
One of the hard things for people to understand is that the more you try to control an economy, the more quickly it falls apart.
Capitalism. God's way of determining who is smart and who is poor.
All right, free market squad and the place to be. Thank you for taking an hour out of your week to hang with me. I am Nathan Frazier, your host with the Hero Complex. This is Anarchopreneur, the Nathan Frazier Show. You, more importantly, you are the free market squad, and I am here every single week. I try to be here every single week to help you be your own boss, both politically and professionally. That's what this show is all about. You can find out more by checking out my podcast website over at NathanFrazierShow.com. Before we jump into it, a big shout out to Truth Frequency Radio Network, UCY.TV, LRN.FM, and everybody else out there that helps promote this here podcast. I do appreciate all of the love. And of course, a huge shout out and thank you to you for listening, because otherwise I'd just be a crazy person talking to myself. That's not cool. So this week, in the second half of the show, I'm going to be playing an interview from Bob Berg. This is an interview that I did a while back on Live Free FM, but the content is perfect for the Nathan Frazier Show. And since the Live Free FM podcast is quick to be no longer available, I wanted to make sure that this interview lived on. Bob is the author of a book called The Go-Giver, and the message of the book is just basically how to succeed in a free market. You really need to be focused on giving rather than receiving, and it's a great interview, and I definitely did not want that archive to be lost to the ages, so I am going to go ahead and play that for the second half of this week's show. But before that, this is going to ruffle some jimmies. I'm just going to get that out of the way right now. So this is take two. I recorded a version of this earlier this week, and I was just sick as crap, and I wasn't happy with the way that that one. I was feeling like 60% at the time when I recorded it. I'm back up to about 85% now, so I wanted to re-record the first half of this episode, and what I'm going to be talking about is, well, some of the fears that hold people back, and one of the fears that I think is the most common fear that holds people back, and why I think it shouldn't hold people back. That's a weird way to tease the episode. So first of all, let's just start off by saying this. I am just far beyond ready for this election season to be over. It's at the point now where I really don't even care who wins. Just please make it stop. I mean, like, elect a dog, elect a pineapple. I don't care. Just make it stop. I'm so sick of this whole thing. It's a circus. But in this circus, there are a few lessons to learn, and one of those lessons I'm going to cover in this week's episode. So a lot of fears hold people back from pursuing their dreams, from chasing their dreams. One of those fears is the fear of failure. I think that the fear of failure is probably one of the biggest ones that stops people from even trying. Fear of rejection also stops people from trying. I guess that's kind of similarly related to fear of failure, but rejection's hard when you put your heart and soul into something and people say, oh yeah, no thanks. Yeah, that hurts. That stings. But in order to accomplish anything great, you have to be able to deal with it and keep going. Another one that really holds people back is something that was kind of like drilled into us by our parents. I don't think they do it deliberately, but I do think that they're number one people to blame. And it's the fact that in order to succeed in business, you have to ask strangers for money. And Our parents tell us why, like, one of the first fundamental lessons that we learn as children, don't talk to strangers and don't ask people for money. Thanks a lot, Mom and Dad. You set me up for failure. So that's kind of like a double whammy right there, the having to get over the programming of don't talk to strangers and don't ask people for money. Because if you can't do those two things, you're never going to be able to, succeed in the business world. But I think the biggest one, the biggest fear that holds people back is fear of public humiliation. Like this permeates, they say that one of the biggest fears that people have, even more so than death, and I don't understand how this could be a bigger fear than death, but they say that the fear of public speaking, and closely related to that is the fear of public humiliation. Maybe some of you are super well endowed and this isn't as frightening for you as it is for me, the not so well endowed guy. But sometimes people have fears of going to school naked. Sometimes I have nightmares of getting to work and realizing that I don't have my work clothes with me. And then I don't have any clothes with me. And I'm like, well, this is just awkward. I don't like this one bit. But fear of public humiliation is something that's deep rooted in almost all humans, and myself included. And fortunately, now I don't go to work naked, but other than that one particular thing, I do typically struggle through my fear of public humiliation, but a lot of people don't. Fear of public humiliation really holds people back. And it goes beyond just fear of failure. It's more like the idea that people will think less of you. You'll have less perceived value. And I think the reason that this is so horrifying for most people is because epigenetically, at our roots, at our tribal roots, we are a tribal species. And the less valuable you're perceived to the tribe, the less likely people are going to go out of their way to protect you from the saber-toothed tiger when the tribe gets attacked. The more valuable members are the ones that people are going to rally behind. The less valuable members are the ones that are going to be thrown to the saber-toothed tiger to feed them and keep them distracted while the rest of the tribe runs away. So being perceived as less valuable, being humiliated in public and then having that humiliation lead to the perception of less value or less personal value is just terrifying for most people. And in my opinion, it's probably the biggest fear that keeps people from chasing their dreams. And it's not just like the tribe. We don't want to fail in front of our friends. We don't want to fail in front of our family. We don't want to fail in front of our spouse or our children. And we don't want to fail in front of our fans because personally, just my own personal outtake on this. When I started this new podcast, one of the first things that I promised was I'm going to keep you guys up to date with what's going on in my own business. But for the first like 13 or 14 episodes, I never talked about my own business because I was afraid of the fact that I wasn't having the success right off the bat that I was hoping for. I was afraid that you listening, would mock me and laugh at me. So I just avoided talking about it. So I'm not immune to this. And I know a lot of people that have great ideas, that have brilliant ideas, actually, but they're afraid to tell their significant others about them, or they're afraid to share them with the rest of their friends because they don't want to get encouraged to do something that then they turn around and fail at and then be publicly humiliated. That's just not a comfortable feeling. And because it's so uncomfortable even to think about, it holds a lot of us back. It makes it to where, because we're so afraid of the outcome that we just don't even try. We're so afraid of failing and being humiliated publicly that we just don't even try. But I guess my question is, and the reason that I'm going on this whole rant is public humiliation really that bad? Should it be something that's so feared that it stops people before they even start? I'm going to circle back to where I started out with this conversation. This circus that we're calling the 2016 presidential election. So the first and the second debate have passed by the time that I'm recording this episode. And one thing is clear from watching the public reactions to both of them. People see what they want to see. If you ask who won the debate, if you ask who had the better, more compelling arguments, it depends on who you ask. It depends on who they wanted to win. Two people can watch the exact same debate and you can get two completely different answers from those two different people depending on who they wanted to win. One person's going to say, oh, Trump mopped the floor with Hillary. And the other person's going to say, oh, Trump just fell flat on his face and Hillary won that debate. It was plainly evident. It's because people see what they want to see. And they're incredibly biased and we're very selective as to what we allow to come in and what we decide to reject as part of our reality. And that's just like one level of bias, but this bias actually gets a lot deeper. So a couple of days before this last debate, these infamous Trump tapes came out where he was talking about grabbing a girl in an inappropriate area. And some people, when listening to these tapes, heard blatant, misogynistic sexual assault. Trump is a super predator. Super predator. He needs to be locked up. He's a rapist. You don't trust your children around him. And other people heard locker room banter. Oh, everybody says that kind of stuff. You tell me that you haven't said something similar in the company of your friends in a private area. And tell me that you couldn't have something similar, a dirty joke or something like that, that you've said that is just as damning as what Donald Trump says. And I can see the argument on both sides. But the thing is it was a major embarrassing situation. If any of us had a dirty joke that we told, recorded, and played on every single mainstream media and pointed back at us, look at what a messed up sense of humor this person has. They think that just talking about groping women is something comical and funny. Isn't that disgusting? And it got the spotlight that Donald Trump got from that incident. Most of us would be debilitated by that. Most of us, that would be the most embarrassing. It would cripple us. But Trump keeps going. He got, and I'm not saying anything for Trump. I'm just trying to get a point across. I'm not a supporter of Donald Trump. But he knows the truth. He knows something about human nature that most people are ignorant to. And I'm going to share that here in a little bit. On the other side of the debate, Bill Clinton has done far worse things than the things that Donald Trump just talked about. Bill Clinton actually has been accused of raping multiple women. Bill Clinton not only talked about grabbing a girl in a particular area, he's actually shoved cigars up in that area of women inside of the Oval Office. So, and a lot of the people that you hear like completely attacking Donald Trump for the things that he just said will defend Bill Clinton's actions and defend Hillary Clinton's actions of covering up Bill Clinton's actions. So the amount of hypocrisy and bias in the average person is just astronomical. Now, I want to just be clear about this. I can't stand either one of them. I can't stand Donald Trump. I can't stand Hillary Clinton. I think they're both just deplorable people. Hillary Clinton is a crook. Her emails prove major corruption. Her defending of a rapist in the past, I don't know, maybe you haven't heard about this, but when she first started out her career, she defended somebody that she knew raped a 13-year-old girl, defended the guy anyways, got him off, blamed the victim, and has also threatened, allegedly, that the defending of the rapist is 100% on the record. allegedly people that have been raped by Bill Clinton. She's threatened them. They've settled out of court. She's been very kind of like a strong arm person in handling those situations. So I think she's a vile human being. I think she's disgusting. But Trump, I don't think Trump is any better. Trump gives capitalism a bad name. I'm a capitalist. I hate the fact that when people think of capitalism, they think of people like Donald Trump. He uses eminent domain to steal property from people. He's very shady in a lot of his dealings. He's just refused to pay people. And he just is everything that like every straw man argument you could make about how horrible capitalism is, Donald Trump actually lives up to most of those. And above and beyond that, a lot of his proposed policies are terrifying for privacy advocates and Fourth Amendment advocates. Like stances on stop and search or stop and frisk procedures, which are completely violations of the Fourth Amendment. And he just doesn't care. He's like, I don't care about breaking the law as long as I can. In one sentence, he'll say law and order. And then in the next sentence, he'll say, we're going to violate the law in order to get the order. So both of them, in my opinion, I don't want to see either one of them as president of the United States. I'm horrified by the prospects of both of them. I just wanted to get that out there. But here's the deal. No matter how horrible either one of these two people are, they still have supporters. They have a lot of supporters. Okay, to be fair, a lot of the people that I know that are voting for one or the other aren't really like supporters. They're just so terrified of the other one that they're willing to vote for one that they don't really feel, but at least it's not the other one. The whole lesser of two evil supporters. But some people actually really like one of the two. I know at least two people that really like Hillary Clinton. And I know probably like 20 or 30 people that really like Donald Trump. And it just baffles me on both cases. But whatever. It is what it is. But how can it be this way? How can it, for most of us, at least for the one that we don't agree with, we can look at them and be like, oh my God, they are so evil. How do they still have supporters? For people like me in the middle, I look at both of them and I'm like, how do they still have supporters? How can this be that these two completely corrupt, immoral human beings still have people that support them? How can this be? It's because people see what they want to see. So some people will want to see you fail. And every time you fail, they're going to use it to attack you. They're going to run with it. They're going to take an inch and try and make it into a mile. And some people want to see you succeed. And every time that you make a good step forward, that they're going to turn that into a mile. People will see what they want to see, and they'll see what lines up with what they want to see. So if you take a leap of faith and try to do something great, and I'm not saying running for president or running for any political office is something great or admirable. But if you try and start a business, or if you try and start a podcast, or if you try and start some sort of activist movement, you're going to get both haters and supporters. And the supporters are going to have a bias to only see the good in what you do. And the haters are going to have a bias to only see the bad in what you do. That's just going to be the way it is. So if you make an offhanded comment, the haters are going to say that's sexual harassment. And the supporters are going to say, oh, that's just locker room banter. That's just the way human beings work. And here's the thing. The more haters you get, the more loyal your supporters are going to be. So I, in everything that I do, I actually, you know, if you're going to be cast as the villain, Ben Settle always says this, if you're going to be cast as the villain, play the role to the fullest. I know that certain things that I take a stand on, I'm going to stir up a hornet's nest with some people. I don't care, because I'm going to do it anyways, because I understand that if I have a percentage of my audience or a percentage of the masses out there that aren't going to like my opinion on something, if I can get those people to stand up and raise hell, protesting me, that's going to make my loyal supporters even be that much more loyal. Trump is a good example of this. I know a lot of people that are only voting Trump because of the biased way that the media is treating him. He's, in their opinion, he's like a billionaire underdog, which is really weird to even think about. But because the media hates him so much, that's why a lot of the people that are supporting him that didn't even really like him 6 or 8 months ago, just because of the way his haters are treating him, have turned people on the fence into his supporters. So that's how powerful having haters can be. So if you dare to do anything great with your life, if you dare to start a business, a podcast, a political movement, an activist movement, whatever it is that you dare to do, you are going to have setbacks. You are going to have failures along the way. You will make mistakes. You will fall flat on your face. It happens to everybody. Nobody ever makes it to their intended destination without hitting a couple of stop signs or speed bumps along the way. It's just part of getting to where you need to go. You will have setbacks. You will make mistakes. You will be humiliated in public. And knowing this will keep most people from ever trying. But if anything from this last political season, if anything from the leak of these Donald Trump tapes and the way that half of the people reacted one way and the way that the other half of the people just doubled down in their support for him, and Hillary Clinton's emails, the same thing. The way that some people reacted to Hillary Clinton's emails and said it's the most damning thing ever, and then the way that other people just said, the FBI says it's cool, so I'm not going to look any further into that. That should show you right there that public humiliation should not be nearly as scary as most of us make it out to be in our mind. Now, if you make a mistake, your haters will attack you. If you do something foolish, if you do something embarrassing, there are going to be people that are going to be there to attack you. But your supporters are going to be quick to overlook it. Your supporters are going to say, it's not that big of a deal. And they'll forget about it. They have a really short attention span, a really short memory. And they will continue to support you as long as you're a decent person. And maybe not. I mean, sadly, proven by this election, you can still have supporters even if you're a horrible person. But I feel like giving out this information to you, I feel like I'm doing a good thing. I feel like it's safe because obviously if you're listening to this podcast, I do a really good job of weeding out the dirt bags from my audience, the people that are immoral, the people that don't have a giving spirit. So if you're still listening to this, it's because you are a decent person. So I feel comfortable relaying this information to you. But this is the deal. This is the final point that I want to get across. If you have a dream, but you're afraid that you might make some mistakes, that you might get some egg on your face, that you might look like a fool, that you might be embarrassed in the public eye, it's okay. It will happen, but it's not going to hurt as bad as you think it will. And as long as you get back up and you keep going, your supporters are only going to double down on their support for you. Your haters are going to hate. Ignore them. Serve your supporters. Every ounce of energy that you give to worrying about your haters, you're robbing that energy from the people who care about you, from the people who support you. Don't worry about the haters. Don't worry about the people that point and laugh at you. Spend your time and your energy focusing on the people that are there to lift you back up and keep you going again. Step outside of your comfort zone. Dare to be great. Being great doesn't mean never failing. Being great means getting back up and trying again. And in the long run, people don't remember every time that you fell down. People don't remember every time that you stepped up to base and you swung and you missed. People remember that time that you hit the home run and you had a grand slam. That's the thing that people remember. So you can try and fail 1,000 times, but people are going to remember the one time that you hit it out the ballpark. So don't let the fear of striking out keep you from stepping up to bat and doing what you were meant to do. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back on the other side of the break, we've got an interview. Get your English proper, Nathan. We've got an interview with Bob Berg, the author of The Go-Giver and Adversaries into Allies and a bunch of other stuff. This is probably one of my favorite interviews that I've ever done, so definitely stick around for that. We'll be right back on the other side of the break. This is Anarchopreneur, The Nathan Fraser Show. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Free minds, free markets, free people.
All right, Free Market Squad. Each week, I like to randomly pick one of the members of the Free Market Squad who participates in Self-Promotion Saturday, and I like to give them a shout-out, shine a little bit of spotlight on them. And this week, we are going to be talking about Nancy Marin. Now, Nancy is somebody who does writing and blogging, and she's a copy editor and a content creator. And let me just tell you about this. This is, like I said, randomly picked, but completely synchronistic. I actually just did some business with Nancy. I am about to launch a webinar, and it's about 60 slides long, and I wrote up the whole thing, and I was super impressed with myself. And I said, you know what, I'm gonna run this past the editor real quick just to make sure that I didn't miss anything. And so I hit up Nancy because she had posted that she does editing services. So I hit her up. I sent her the webinar slides, and I expected to get back a few maybe grammatic or spelling errors. Out of 60 slides, I figured she'd at least be able to catch 4 or 5 different areas where I had made mistakes. She sent it back to me, and almost every single page, she had caught something that I had completely done incorrectly. And this is embarrassing to me because I'm a copywriter. I get paid to write ads for people, to write advertising campaigns, to write emails for people. And she totally pointed out tons of mistakes that I had made. And now going into this webinar, I'm feeling much more confident that I'm not going to look like a total fool, because from before what I sent her to what I got afterwards, a giant world of difference, and I am almost embarrassed at the original draft that I sent her after seeing all of her edits. So if you want to avoid looking like a fool to your audience, and you've got something written that you want to have just a phenomenal copy editor go over and point out all of your flaws and make you feel completely ashamed of yourself. No, I'm just playing. Make you feel much more confident about what you're about to launch. I cannot recommend Nancy enough. So, and she spells her name a little bit weird. And so if you just look up Nancy Marin, you might not find her. So I'm going to spell out her website. It's NancyMarin.com. That's NancyMarin.com. Nancy Marin. If you need some editing done, holler at this girl. She blew my mind with how amazing she is. Are you a liberty-minded entrepreneur, small business owner, agorist, or freelancer? Do you ever struggle in your business and feel like you're all alone in the world? Can you imagine how great it would be if there were a community of freedom-loving business people just waiting to connect with you? Can you keep a secret? There is such a community. Free Market Squad is the online mastermind group for people who are passionate about freedom and success in life. Access to a mastermind group is probably one of the most valuable things you could have in your life, and membership in the Free Market Squad is absolutely free. If you have a Facebook account and you want more information on how to join the Free Market Squad, head on over to www.freemarketsquad.com. That's freemarketsquad.com.
Let me ask you something. Haven't you ever been tempted to just break the rules and finally
get back at my big faceless corporate bosses for making me feel so small and insignificant?
Look at this, Marge. $58 and all of it profit. I'm the smartest businessman in the world.
Government can print money, but it's the entrepreneurs who really make the money.
Why don't you guys just make your cars cleaner and nicer and try to be better to your customers so that you can compete with Handy Car's popularity in the marketplace?
Shut up and take my money.
All right, Free Market Squad, we are back. This is Anarchopreneur, the Nathan Fraser Show. Check out more over at NathanFraserShow.com. I'm not going to waste any time. We're just going to jump right into the interview. All right, today we have Bob Berg, who is the author of the international bestseller, The Go-Giver, and I think, sold over 500,000 copies now, co-author with another, well, I'll let you get into that, Bob. Let's go ahead and just introduce you and jump right into the show. Bob Berg.
Oh, thank you, Nathan. Great to be with you. And yes, it was it's a business parable, co-authored with John David Mann, who's an absolutely fantastic writer and storyteller. So it was sort of a good collaboration. I'm a how-to guy. I'm step one, step two, step three. And John, not that he can't do the how-to, but he's just a fantastic writer. So it was a good combination.
Now, this has become fast one of my favorite books of all time. And I read a lot of books, so for it to be in my probably top five favorite books and definitely my top two or three favorite business books.
Thank you.
I love the book. I've talked about the book before on the show. And then I started listening to you. I started trying to find some interviews and some other material from you. And you started dropping some hints in some of your interviews that I thought would make you a perfect guest for Anarchopreneur, the Live Free FM podcast. And so first of all, I want to say thank you for coming on. And before we even jump into it, where can people go to find out more about you and your work?
Probably the best place is my website, which is berg.com, and pretty much everything's there. Information about my books, my blog, where I can be found on social media, and so forth.
Okay, so I want to start off the conversation by tackling probably one of the biggest misconceptions that I have come across, and this was something that actually I had to do a 180 in my thinking as well. Growing up, we get constantly inundated by the television. We've got Mr. Burns on The Simpsons clinking his fingers together and counting his money. We get Scrooge McDuck. We get constantly this portrayal of the evil, greedy capitalist who's in it for himself. And the way to succeed in the world is to stab as many people in the back and take as much money from them as possible. And schools teach us this. Higher education teaches us this. Television teaches us this. This is a message that bombards us from all different directions to where by the time we're old enough to enter the workplace, capitalist is almost like a pejorative. It's almost like a dirty word that people don't want to have tied to themselves. And now in our current political spectrum, it's become even more run through the mud, especially with some of the political debates going on right now. You seem to, in your book, you come at it from a totally different way. The common conception that capitalists are greedy and takers, and that's how you become successful in the marketplace. You seem to have a different idea. Would you like to expand on why you see it a little bit differently?
Sure. And what you say is correct. Society is absolutely bombarded with those messages. Back when I was, when I was growing up, it was J.R. Ewing of the TV show Dallas. He was the greedy capitalist. And then years ago, remember the movie It's a Wonderful Life, and which people have grown up seeing every year 18 times, and they see George Bailey, right, who is always at war with the Mr. Potter, right, the greedy capitalist banker who will do nothing, let nothing stand in his way of your money because he's so greedy. And when we're taught that by the world and we grow up seeing those messages, it's very hard. And as you say, in school, when that's what we're taught, it's very hard to not, on an unconscious level, really get trapped into that kind of thinking. And it's really incorrect. Now, not that there aren't bad people out there. Of course there are. But that has nothing to do with the economic system of capitalism, which is the only economic system that has raised the standard of living to such a phenomenal degree everywhere where it has been able to, allowed but to flourish. And it capitalism actually makes it so that the poor in a mostly free capitalist society are much better off than even the middle class in a less free society. And you would think that after the 75 years of communism and socialism that the world went through, and the tens of millions of murders and the hundreds of millions of people in the gulags and jails and the bread lines where people waited freezing for stale sausage, you'd think people would get the hint that maybe that kind of stuff doesn't really work. And yet, you know, we don't see that at all. We see now even more of a movement to the economic left. And one of the things we need to realize, especially when we are looking to educate those on the political economic left as to why that system doesn't work, it's understanding that they're not bad people. It's not that people who are socialistic in nature or who believe in a big government, it's not that they're bad people or have bad intent. Typically, they're nice people who have very nice intent. They want to see the poor helped, and they want to see people have an even chance. They simply don't realize, for whatever reason, that capitalism is actually what does provide that help and what provides that chance for people. But here's an issue, and this is one reason why it's so misunderstood. What we have in our system, in our economic system, is really not capitalism. It's not mainly capitalism. It's mainly cronyism, what some people call crony capitalism. And I don't even like to use that word, because to me it almost legitimizes that as a part of capitalism. Crony capitalism is to capitalism what Chinese checkers is to checkers. Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing.
I would go so far to say that we're almost, and I know this is kind of a bit of an extreme take on it, but I would go so far as to say we're almost living in a corporate fascist economy right now. Do you think that's going too far?
No, because there is a lot of that, but it's corporate, and it's all sorts of special interests. And sure, that there's a lot of that. And when you think of it, you know, socialism and statism and all the different, many of the different isms, they combine in many ways. But whenever you have the big corporations buying the interests, P.J. O'Rourke said it best. He said, when the legislature is left to determine who can buy and sell, the first things to be bought and sold will be the legislature. And I think that's really what it is. And so with cronyism, or what John Allison used to call crony socialism, because that's really what it is, that's the unfair advantage. Capitalism in its true form is simply, aside from the respecting of property rights, which is so important, meaning that the individual, him or herself, is their property, as well as what they have purchased, what they own. Capitalism is simply the free exchange of products and services between two or more willing parties, with government's legitimate function being simply to protect the citizenry from force and fraud. Now, I'm not really sure how anyone can, on the most basic level, disagree with that. Don't people want others to be free? And I think most people on the political left want people to be free. I think people on the political right basically want people to be free. What happens is, though, is each one of them has their own special areas where maybe they don't want people to be free. So what they're willing to do is use government force to enforce people doing things their way. Well, what they don't realize is everyone has their own couple of things that they would like government to force others to do. And when you put them all together, you get socialism or statism, what have you.
And I guess this would be a good time to talk about the incentive structure of capitalism versus central planning. When we leave complex social problems to be left or to be handled by politicians rather than entrepreneurial type people out there, what's the difference between how the two are incentivized to take care of the problems? Because I grew up on welfare and I grew up on food stamps and all of that, and believing that taxation was the way to get my fair share and take other people's fair share, and that was the best way to provide for the poor. I don't believe that anymore. But as far as when entrepreneurial minded people take on social problems versus when politicians take on social problems, what are the reasons why we see free market solving problems better than, it seems like every problem the state takes on, the problem just gets worse and worse.
Gets worse. And well, it's for a couple of reasons, and incentives are absolutely a huge part of it. With government, they can be in certain government programs, they can be very well intended. Now, sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're a result of special interests who couch a certain thing as for the good of, right? But it really isn't. But let's say it is, and let's say let's look at Lyndon Johnson, who ushered in the Great Society back in the mid '60s, right? And his war on poverty, certainly a righteous thought, of course. Who wants poverty? We want to help people. And what he said was, the war on poverty will end all poverty as we know it in this country within 2 years. And you know, that would cause me to kind of refer to the Dr. Phil question, how's that working out for you? And it really doesn't, because look at the incentives. The incentive is not to help oneself as much as to stay trapped, unfortunately. And also what happens is government workers, those who are employed to help people in these programs, they have good intent. But remember, they have to protect their jobs. And so it behooves them not really to help people out of the system, but to keep people within the system. And again, I say this not in a conspiratorial way, that they don't even realize they're doing that. Again, they've got good intent, but good intent plus negative results does not equal positive results. And what happens typically is with a private charity, that private charity is there for the purpose of helping people to help themselves. So charity is a great thing. Charity is a wonderful, fantastic thing. It's magnificent. But as George Washington said, government is not charity. It is not eloquence. It is force. And force just doesn't generally work out, because people are different. People are individuals. As Harry Brown, one of my great libertarian teachers, used to say, you know, everyone seeks happiness, right, as individuals, but happiness is relative. We all see happiness in our own unique ways. And what brings one person happiness is meaningless to someone else, or might cause them unhappiness. And by the very nature of any government program, it's one size fits all. And typically the person making the decision does not know that person who is having to do a certain thing.
Well, and also the fact that they don't have to make the customer or the taxpayer or the citizen happy in order to ensure the payment.
That's the big thing. Yeah. That's exactly right. That's a fantastic point. There is no incentive for them to produce. In fact, you could say with a government program, there's actually more incentive for them not to produce.
Yeah, it's sad that most people can't see it that way. I'd like to get back to the focus of what is in your book, The Go-Giver, because I just love the message in it. And you said it's a parable. It's more of a story than an instructional type book, but it does have very good implementable action in it. One of the main things that keeps coming up in the book is the exact opposite of the common belief that in order to be successful, you have to take more than you give. And your main message seems to counter that. Would you like to explain from your experiences why you believe that giving is actually what benefits you more in a true free market economy?
Sure. Well, law number one, the law of value, simply says that you're true worth is determined by how much more you give in value than you take in payment. Now, this is a very counterintuitive type of phrase, because it sounds like a recipe for bankruptcy, right? If you give more in value than you take in payment, how long can you stay in business that way? So we simply have to understand the difference between price and value, and this is the key. Price is a dollar figure. It's a dollar amount. It's finite. It is what it is. Value, on the other hand, is the relative worth or desirability of something to the end user or beholder. In other words, what is it about this thing, this product or service, concept, idea, what have you, that brings so much worth, so much value that someone will willingly exchange their money? And that's the key. Remember, in a free market-based economy, it's the willing exchange. No one's forced to buy from you. So they'll willingly exchange their money and feel great about it while you still make a profit. And let me give you just one example of how this might work. Let's say you hire an accountant to do your taxes. And this accountant charges you $1,000. We'll just name a round figure. Charges you $1,000. That's his fee, or literally, it's his price, $1,000. But what value does he give you in exchange for this price? Well, through his years of experience and studying his craft, through his focus on you and what you're looking to accomplish, from getting to know your business, from being totally focused on bringing you the best value possible, he's able to save you $5,000 in taxes. He also saves you countless hours of work, and he provides you and your family with the security and peace of mind of knowing it was done correctly. So what he's done is he's given you well over $5,000 in value or use value to you, right? In exchange for $1,000 payment or price. So he gave you more in value than what he took in payment. So you feel great about it, right? You paid $1,000, you received well over $5,000 in value. But remember, he made an excellent profit as well. To him, charging $1,000 for the few hours or whatever he did as far as work, that's very worthwhile to him, or he wouldn't have done it in a free market. So both parties actually win. And this is why we say that money is an echo of value. It's the thunder to value's lightning. In other words, the value comes first. That's going to be at the forefront. That's the focus. The value comes first, and the money you receive is simply a very natural result of the value you've provided. Again, going back to one of my libertarian mentors, Harry Brown, who used to say, in a free market, profit is simply the result of pleasing another individual.
I think another thing that story really illustrates is that in a voluntary interaction, both people come out with more than what they went in.
And, exactly.
And neither one, if it's a voluntary interaction, neither one is being exploited, which right. is one of those key words that we keep hearing coming up is, well, these people are rich because they're exploiting you. But in a true laissez-faire free market, those people cannot get rich unless they're giving you more than what you feel like you're giving them.
Exactly. Only with cronyism, where someone is forced to do business with someone, or that the special laws and regulations have made something a monopoly. You know, monopolies have never in our country. A monopoly has never taken place in our country in a laissez-faire situation. Any monopoly has always been because of government intervention or government sponsorship, such as the post office or something like that. But people have tried. Don't get me wrong. People are people, and people will try to get a monopoly. But it has never actually happened. And anyone who ever, whatever someone calls me on that, I'll just say, just find something. Find any example of a monopoly that has ever actually been able to take place where government wasn't either the cause or involved in some way, or the sponsor. Can't do it.
And that actually segues perfectly into what I'd like to kind of finish this interview with, which is the new reemergence of kind of a free market capitalism For a long time, I know growing up my whole life, there was a lot of regulations that were definitely centralizing the market into a small number of gatekeepers' hands. And we had all these different bottlenecks, whether it was entertainment industry and the music industry and all of these different services, academia for one. And in the last couple of years, the internet has just destroyed that, and it's given back. We're seeing a reemergence of all these small business owners being able to compete. And one of the biggest things is content marketing, where people are just giving and giving and giving in order to earn trust. And it harkens back to the message in your book of giving in order to be successful. What are your thoughts about this new emergence of entrepreneurialism and the idea of content marketing, where we see people on YouTube giving away their content for free and avoid, like, I was just reading an article about a musician who tried to sell her stuff to the music labels. They told her no, so she started her own YouTube channel, and now she's a multimillionaire, and she's got these old bottleneck gatekeepers knocking down her right door trying to get her. So when it comes to courses, when it comes to YouTube, when it comes to all these new avenues that people have, how do you feel about this going forward as far as the spirit of entrepreneurialism is concerned?
Oh, I think it's fantastic. The internet has definitely leveled the playing field. So you've got this one person or two person company that can actually compete for business with these dinosaurs, these monoliths, you know, and it's fantastic. And you can, with content marketing, it does allow that person to put a lot of material out there in the marketplace in order to develop what we call the know, like, and trust relationships, which causes someone to want to do business with you more and to pay you. You know, when you market through the internet and you do something such as provide special reports or free videos or again on YouTube, all the different content, you're by the nature of doing that itself, that's giving, and that's fantastic. That's not the end goal. As far as when we talk about giving value, we want to be paid, and that should be in a for-profit business. They need to be paid, and that's a great thing. But the giving away of content is a fantastic strategy in order to build that relationship. And there's no one who can keep you from doing that. And that's such a great thing. And so people who do that effectively and are able to develop those know, like, and trust relationships, now they have a relationship with this person, and they're able to market in a way that benefits everyone.
Yeah, and it's, to me, it's awesome because it's a reemergence, and it's kind of going back to the traditional values that made capitalism be so successful in the early part of the founding of this country. I'm really excited about it. Before we're out of here, I'd like to give people a chance to know or learn a little bit more about you and some of the things that you've got going on. I already mentioned your book, The Go-Giver, but I know there's some news about that I'd like to let our listeners know about.
Well, it just came out in an expanded version where, of course, we didn't change the story itself, but we did add a discussion guide at the end of it and a question and answer section. We have so many companies that use the book within their sales force and leadership team. We have religious institutions that utilize it in their discussion groups, book clubs, as well as high schools and even colleges across the country that use it. So we thought it would be great to be able to, with the celebration of the half million sold mark, to be able to put a discussion guide and question and answer section in there that would actually help facilitate the conversation. So we're very excited about that.
Awesome. I'm going to have to definitely pick up the new version of the book. I know that the old version is one of my favorite books, like I mentioned earlier. Where can people go to find out more about you, Bob? And where would you like to give our listeners one final thought before we're out of here?
Well, yeah, first they can come to burg.com, and pretty much everything's there. They can find out more information about the book and connect with me online. You know, I really think that in a sense, it's that shift in focus. It's moving from an I focus or a me focus to an other focus, looking for ways to constantly and consistently add value to the lives of others. And there's nothing about that that is self-sacrificial or martyrish or nothing like that. It's simply understanding that to the degree we can genuinely and authentically focus on making other people's lives better, that's the degree that people are going to know us, like us, and trust us, want to do business with us, want to refer us to others, and want to be a part of our lives.
Awesome. And to really tie up all of this, there is a chapter, the last chapter of your book is the law of reciprocity.
Receptivity.
Receptivity.
Yeah, there is a law of reciprocity that Dr. Robert Cialdini talks about in his book, Influence, Science and Practice. And it's a fantastic book and a fantastic principle. Ours is a little different in which receptivity, in which we talk about the importance of allowing ourselves to receive. Because when we have focused on providing value to others and touching the lives of many others with the exceptional value we provide, we've earned the right, not the entitlement, but the right to receive. And we've got to, as you mentioned at the beginning of the program, we've got to sort of put aside, consciously put aside all those messages of lack that we receive and understand that that earning money is a fantastic thing when you first provided value to others. So don't buy into the premise that, you know, if you're earning a great income, it's on the backs of others or you did something wrong. No, so long as no one's forced to do business with you, the only way you can earn a great income and allow yourself to receive it and feel good about it is when you've provided value to others.
All right. Thanks to Bob for hanging out with the Free Market Squad today, giving us his great insights. If you want to learn more, actually, if you want to check out Bob's podcast, head on over to thegogiver.com. Bob Berg, the author of The Go Giver and host of the new podcast, The Go Giver, thegogiver.com. Until next time, Free Market Squad, faith in each other, not in authority. I'm out of here. Deuces.
Free minds, free markets, free people.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. You like listening to podcasts, don't you? Have you ever thought about starting a podcast of your own? If you're a hardcore podcast fan, you probably have, and you've probably got something great to share with the world. I'm Nathan Frazier, and I've created a free online podcasting course for people just like you. Pre-Launch Secrets gives you the top 5 secrets you need to know in order to launch a successful podcast. You'll learn how to create the core concept of your podcast, how to build a solid audience, and how to consistently generate great content for that audience. These are the secrets the pros use when coming up with ideas for their podcasts. And after this course, you'll have them all at your disposal. The course is free. It's taught by me. Enroll today. Go to podcastblastoff.com/course. That's podcastblastoff.com/course. Podcast Blastoff, the future of podcasting.